Hello and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in true crime talk radio. True Crime Tuesday is on the air. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. And joining us again, one of our all-time favorite guests, Alan R. Warren, is back. Alan, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
Listen, guys, this is very hard for me to admit, but I think that something needs to be done. And I've chosen this show today with my two friends to finally acknowledge that I might be in a bit of a bind I've never found myself truly in before. So for a lot of people, you know, you listen to the shows, you hear Tim and I laughing and having fun. And what you don't realize is that behind the scenes, I'm actually homebound. I'm not allowed out much. I'm forced to do these radio shows, and the people that are the ones that are behind this and forcing me are treating me like terrorists. They wake me up all night long by slamming into my doors, climbing on my chest, smothering me in my sleep, trying to trip me down flights of stairs, and insisting I feed them constantly. I'm talking about the cats that live in my house, guys. I've realized now that I've become a complete victim to these beasts, and I don't know how to get out of it. I don't know how to get my life back, gentlemen. I live, it seems, only to buy them more food and toys and supply their catnip habit.
Like other good parents, just move.
Yeah, and don't tell them.
Don't tell them. Move.
I like Alan's suggestion a lot, actually.
It has been, you know, we moved into our new house, and this has been a nightmare. They figured out that if they hit my door the right way, it opens at night. So they're either banging it, like they're throwing each other into it. They're doing the old Cannonball Express, Tim, where the big cat's winging the small cat at the door.
Oh, dear God.
To knock it open. And then if I don't answer, they keep rapping at it and screaming outside. It's insane. I've never had this before.
So acrobat cats.
Right. So terroristic cat. However, on the other side of things, I bring that up to bring up another story before we get going, because this doesn't fit into the dumb crime, stupid criminals category we always do at the end of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't fit in with what we're about to talk about. But there is a real hero out there. And this, I don't know if you've seen this video of this cat. It's insane. This cat is laying, the family's got like one of those nanny cams. This cat is laying on the couch. And there's a little toddler, maybe like, I don't know, 14, 15, 16 months old, sitting on the floor playing.
Okay.
And all of a sudden, the toddler starts crawling to the stairway by himself. And he gets to the top stair. The cat leaps off the couch, flies around. It looks like he's brutally attacking the kid, but he's biting the kid's shirt and dragging the kid back from the top stair. And then when he can't do that, he gets around in front of the kid and starts pushing the kid. So heroics, man, I got to tell you, whether you believe in the supernatural, paranormal, reincarnation or what, this goes down as a heroic cat. I don't know if we can include, I'll try to include the link to that video on today's program. But, you know, we like to acknowledge heroes when they pop up, Tim.
Oh, sure. Sure, Dave. But we do need to ask the question. This is a very valid question. Was this not just the cat showing off for the owner so that later this is just a subtle diversion so that the cat can strike. Yeah, so the cat can strike later and potentially injure the child.
I don't know. Yeah, and then go to a dark, dark place, man.
And then just blame it on someone else later.
There's that option, but yeah. I would like to think that's not what happened. But a tip of the hat to the hero cat. How about that? Ooh, I like that. A little rhyme involved. Let's dive into today's tide. I'm going to send that video and try to put the link up on today's program. So folks, look for it. Cat video. It's the one time you'll see us post a cat video on True Crime Tuesday. But it's an astounding video. Like if they would have edited it and cut out where you see the kid crawling to the stairs and the cat's just on the couch watching him, it would look like this cat was trying to kill the kid.
Mm-hmm.
But you realize the cat only goes into full-on attack mode when the kid hits the top stair and is about to go down a very steep flight of stairs. This cat does everything in its will to keep this kid from going down those stairs. It's insane. Anyway, so look for that on today's show. And you can find a link to our guest's book, Hannibal the Cannibal, The True Story of Robert Maudsley. And this is a book. This is coming out. When is this actually officially breaking? Alan?
In the U.S., November 29th.
Excellent. So just a few weeks from now, this book will be coming out. Now, this is not a name. Now, obviously, Hannibal the Cannibal, we're all familiar with, thanks to Hannibal Lecter and The Silence of the Lambs. But Robert Maudsley, this name kind of eludes me. Introduce us, if you would, to who Robert Maudsley is.
Well, Robert Maudsley is a serial killer out of the UK. And, you know, he got termed Hannibal the Cannibal because of his, you know, he liked to eat people's brains and things. He liked to have that image. And what they took from him was he's in one of those cells that you see in the movie. Like the one you see with Hannibal the Cannibal in the movie is almost a duplicate of what he lives in.
And, you know, at what point in his life does this guy tip the scales and suddenly decide murder and eating is the way he wants to be remembered?
You know, I don't know if he really did, because initially when he killed his first victim, he was actually arrested and placed in a mental institute, Broadmoor. He actually got put there for the murder. They classified him as insane and not suitable to stand trial. And it was when he was in that hospital, he had killed two others. And it just shortly what they did was they tried him as being sane, even though he was in an insane asylum. And so they ended up putting him in Wakefield Prison, and this really upset him. So his first crack at, so to speak, at eating people was done as a show, because he wanted to prove to the justice system and to the guards, I'm insane. I should be back in the hospital. He really hated the prison and wanted to go back in the hospital. So his eating of brain and putting the spoon in the head after he cut it open was a show.
So he gets put into the loony bin because he's not mentally stable enough to stand trial. While in the loony bin, he ends up taking the lives of two more people. When he takes these lives, is he trying to eat them as well?
No, not at all. And when you go back to the very young Robert Maudsley, he was one of 12 kids. And he was put in an orphanage quite often with a lot of his siblings. And he would go back home. The parents would retrieve him after a few years. And he claims his father would rape him and beat him. And we can't really find proof of that, but social services did take him from the home. So it might be true, or it might just be his words. And so when he got arrested for doing the original killing, he was telling the psychiatrist he would hear voices, and voices would tell him what to do. And so they classified him as insane. So when he was in that Broadmoor insane asylum, who he was killing and who he was targeting was pedophiles.
Oh.
He never ever killed a non-pedophile, let's just say that.
So he was very much in the vein of Hannibal Lecter and Dexter, right? Kind of doing more to rid the world of what he thought of as bad people.
Right. And the very first killing in 1974, I believe it was, when he was still a kid, he was a rent boy. He would go out and sleep with men for money. And this one regular he had, one time when they were together, pulled out all these pictures of children in sexual and beaten positions. And that made him go insane. And he killed that guy. And that's the original one he got put away for. So with him claiming that his father raped him, being in and out of orphanages, and having this guy show him pictures, that sent him off the edge, so to speak. And so when he was in Broadmoor, when he found out someone was a pedophile or it been there for some sort of sexual assault toward kids, he would attack them. His goal was just to kill pedophiles. It was not a show. He didn't get into the eating and showing off, really, until he got into prison.
Do you believe that the original attack was the intent to get put into jail so that he could take out
these? No, I think the very first one was very real. I mean, he was a drug addict. He was on the streets. He was sleeping with a lot of men for money. That was his lifestyle. And then this one guy he had been with, his claim was 10 times. So this was a regular customer of his. And he wouldn't just jump off and kill him unless there was a reason. And I think it really hurt him what his father did, and it stayed with him. And you know, in quite a few of his talks and letters that we got from him, he would talk about how if he had only killed his parents, none of this would have happened. So he has a real anger, especially toward his father. And I think he just went off on this guy because the pictures he showed him, you know, they were like, you know, kids being garroted and tied up naked and really being tortured. And that threw him over the edge. I think it came really close to his young life and what he claimed his father did to him.
Do you think that, all right, so here's the case then. And maybe you have better insight in on this. He does that crime because of what he'd been through and takes about. Do you think that they were kind of lenient on him instead of putting him in prison? They were going to give the insane defense because, let's face it, he just got rid of a really kind of shitty human being. And then once he started killing in the asylum, there was really no way to kind of protect that angle. And obviously, if he's going by his story of having been abused and treated like this, he must be in his right mind because he's attacking the same kind of people that hurt him growing up.
I think it was a combination. He's a kid. He's in trouble. He's doing drugs. He's sleeping with men. He's prostituting. You know, he's not living a good lifestyle. So I think it was a combination of them feeling sorry for him or compassion for him. And why he killed this guy, it has to be said, you know, I think that people like to see pedophiles or people that hurt kids, tortured or put away or beat up or whatever. There's that natural inclination. So I think it's fair enough to say that, you know, that they felt empathy for him. And at the same time, his psychological evaluation was that of hearing voices and you know, he was not a normal adjusted kid.
No, that's a shame. So when he's in the asylum, how quick in succession does he commit these other murders?
Oh, it was quick. Actually, I believe within the first month, he decided to he had this way about him, and I think he'd lose control of his emotions. He seemed to come across someone and find out that they were enjoying sex with children by just a conversation, and he would fixate on them. That was it. This person needed to die, and so it didn't take long. And in fact, the two of them, when he killed them. One wasn't enough. He killed them both in the same day.
I guess, right. If you know you're going to do it and you know you're going to get caught, strike fast and do as much damage as you can, especially if that's kind of his philosophy, was to take out the bad guys.
Yeah. And it was interesting because, he was proud of what he was doing in the sense of, he would tell everyone that they deserved to die. Like, they were pedophiles. They were bad people. They do not deserve to live. So he was proud of it. He, you know, even going to the guards when he killed those two and saying, well, you're short two more for roll call. You know, he sort of had a nonchalant, very proud, like, hey, they deserved it.
Yeah. Wow, that's some balls. Did they keep him in the asylum then, or did they move him to prison at that point awaiting trial.
No, that was the problem. He figured he was insane, and he's in an insane asylum for murder, and he killed two more in an insane asylum. They'll keep him there. But for some reason, the Justice Department decided he would be tried for murder and not be tied to being insane. So they actually give him a trial for murder. And this time he was convicted and he was held accountable. So they moved him to Wakefield Prison. And this really threw him off even more. And
well, how in doing that trial, I mean, how quickly does this go through? And do they try him for all three crimes at that point? Or are they just trying him for the two murders while he was in the asylum?
No, just the two murders in the asylum. And, you know, and this is in England. And so what they do is they try you for if you're culpable of it and whether you did it. So he was tried and convicted that he did it. And he thought he would be found non-culpable because he's insane. And what they did was they actually found him responsible. So he actually got murder convictions rather than putting in insane. So they moved him into Wakefield. And it was rather quick. And this really, really upset him. See, the trial didn't last long because he admitted it. He was proud of what he did. So it's not like he was trying to hide any of this, or he was trying to defend himself saying, no, I didn't do it, or I was insane, or anything like that. He just figured they knew he was insane, and he would stay in Broadmoor in the hospital. And when he didn't, he just went off even more.
Once he's put into the prison system, is he isolated? Is he kept on his own? Is he sharing a cell? What's life like for him once he gets there?
Well, initially he was put in a general population, so to speak. Now, Wakefield Prison is for the worst of the worst. You're not going to get basic crimes in that prison. So even in the general pop, you've got they're all murderers, usually several times murderers. And then in certain segregations, you've got even more severe killers. But it didn't take long for him to be put in kind of an isolation into a 23-hour-a-day prison cell. And that was because he attacked a guard.
It's crazy, isn't it? When you realize he murdered one guy who was a bad guy. He murdered two more while in an asylum. And that they just kind of put him in general populace. It almost makes you wonder, were they kind of hoping he was going to do a little bit more damage before they had to put him in isolation?
Well, you know, that's certainly, it's funny because he's actually got a group of people that support him and rally behind him. And they have their own web pages and everything. And they take it that he's fighting for prisoners' rights. Now, so the whole onset of this is all about prisoners having better conditions and food and rights and things. But at the same time, you know, he's killing other prisoners. It's kind of a bizarre mix here. And so he really thinks he's doing something good. And the prisoners, now, the prison guards kind of, I don't think they really, how do I say this without being attacked? I don't think they care. Now, I'm going to, yeah, it's kind of a, I'm trying to find the right word.
I get what you mean. I understand. And I know you're not meaning to be disrespectful. And there are great guards out there who do care and are a part of it. But then there's also got to be that kind of concept of being, you know, watching over this, these chronic abusers, these chronic criminals, and just realizing, you know, in some cases, maybe the world is better off without them.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's got to be tough being from the guard side in something like Wakefield, where you've got the worst of the worst. You've got the worst killers in the country there. These people are really savage, and to deal with that on a daily basis must put you in a position of the last thing you're thinking of is empathy for the prisoner.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's less. Well, and pedophiles are now, I don't know if it's just a Hollywood, you know, trope, but it always seems that they're the ones targeted by just about anybody. And even like Dahmer, you know, who was murdered in prison, you know, a lot of these guys that did crimes like that, it's almost a badge of honor to take them out and get them out of the system.
Yeah, and it gives you more credibility, right, in prison. It moves you up in the ranks. And, you know, lifers are there, and it's a situation that they're making for themselves. They've got to move up, otherwise they're on the end that's always getting beaten up and raped and attacked and things taken from them. So it's about that credibility. So you take out someone that's really popular, and you're going to move up. People are going to be scared of you. And that is actually the key to this Hannibal, this Maudsley, because when he was in there, then he started doing the brutal killings and doing the display of eating brain, so that his reputation became beyond what he expected, actually, because this led to him being kind of feared by even some of the most brutal killers in prison with him. And now, if you see Maudsley and you see the picture of him,
right,
he's kind of a, he's not, I wouldn't think twice. If you saw someone like him on the road or walking through the mall, you wouldn't look twice at him. He's just a skinny kind of average person. You don't look at him as like anything savage. You wouldn't choose him to be in your movie if you're doing a movie about Hannibal.
Now, I've got to understand. I mean, he's obviously under watch while he's in this prison system. And as you said, maybe the guards just didn't care as much. But murdering somebody seems like a moment of opportunity. How does it go from a moment of opportunity to being able to display someone and eat their brains and not get stopped or seen before that happened?
Well, again, after his initial encounter where he was put in and in solitary, he came out and he was back in general. And he had, no matter what people say, he had actually planned this. This concept of eating someone, he wanted to do, and he wanted to do this in front of people, and he wanted to make sure that they knew this. So when you see this, he isn't the person like Dahmer, like you mentioned. He wasn't eating to get spirit from the body or for any other reason. He was doing this just to be put back in the insane asylum. So when he was walking around in general, he was looking for his victims. He knew what he was going to do and how he was going to do everything that he did. It was a totally planned operation, in the sense of he started looking, and in fact, and what gives it away too is when he got his first victim and took him and killed him, he threw him under his bunk, and then he went back out looking for a second one. And this is the one that really, really...
Wait a minute. You just make it sound casual. Oh, yeah, he went out, he got one, killed him, threw him under his bunk, then went out looking for another. This isn't like a high-priced, low-security hotel. This is prison, Alan. How did he kill somebody, throw him underneath his bunk, and then have the ability to just kind of roam around looking for another victim? And maybe we can go back. Why did he pick this first guy? What specifically about him made him, you know, kind of stand out?
Well, this is kind of the at first it was very confusing, and going through the notes and even going through his letters to figure out, so why are you doing this? Like the first one, I hate to say it so flippantly, but he just killed him and threw him under the bed. That's really what he did. It wasn't about a display with the first one. So you think, well, why did you do it? You have this other plan of taking this prisoner and doing this display killing, and you're taking a chance by taking someone else out. And I think what it was this guy that he took out to begin with was a really well-known, not only pedophile, but child killer, you know, of several children. And he brutally raped and killed them. So his goal was just to take this guy out. This guy was just kind of, think of Robert Maudsley in his mind going, okay, I'm going to do this display killing. I'm going to go back to Broadmoor. They're going to put me in an insane asylum again. So he's on his way doing it. He thought, well, I need to take this guy out. You know, I've got to take this. I don't want to say the word, but he's got to take this killer out, this pedophile murderer. And so it was kind of an opportunity, and figuring that he'd be taken out of that prison, he wouldn't have that chance again. So it was just kind of a courtesy kill, so to speak.
Oh, geez. So his tactic is he's going to try to kill two in a row, or was he going to go for more?
Well, his tactic was, no, he hadn't figured out the person he was going to do this to for the display. So what he thought is, what he was thinking was, he was just going to take out anybody that deserved it before he got taken out of that prison. And that was the bottom line. And he had a few people on his list. And a few of them actually, even he tried to lure them into his cell, and they wouldn't go. And I think there was a little bit of general talk around the population, knowing kind of what he had in mind. And unfortunately, I think he had told other people there was some sort of communication, because there was other prisoners that knew what was going on at the time. So it was really a courtesy kill. The main event was going to happen that same day, but it was kind of on the way to the market.
This first kill, then, Alan, was there any aspect of eating him, or no? He was too busy because he was looking for his next victim.
Yeah, no, this was not for the display. The other one he wanted to take. And he wanted to take in a general situation where people saw it happening and the guards would be attracted. He wanted to draw them. So it was kind of it wasn't happening. He wasn't getting them. So eventually what he did was he was going through the cells, and he saw this one prisoner that he knew of sleeping on his bed. So he went into the room, and he actually closed the cell door, and he had jammed it. He had planned this. He had taken pieces of different material that he had from his plastic knives and different things, and he had jammed the door. So then he took that prisoner, and I have a full description of it at the beginning, of how he started choking him and trying to kill him and banging his head. And slowly, once he got him incapacitated, is when he took him and started smashing his head against the wall. And he was doing it so hard that the plaster and everything was just flying off the wall. And eventually, of course, a big crowd gathered, and they were all watching it, including guards and even a couple of nurses. And he did this whole display, and they say that, now this really confused me, because in the actual prison report, they said that he tortured this guy for several hours before the guards could get in, and I could never figure out how he did that,
right?
And why did they let it go on for so long? And so as he was smashing the head anyway, he eventually got an opening and cracked his head open, and would use his plastic spoon to dig into the brain and put it into his mouth while everyone was watching. He really wanted that to be the impression people got about him.
So he was really going for the kill stroke, not just in what he was doing, but in reputation. He wanted people to see just how dark he really was.
Exactly. That was the whole point of it. Now, there's a few other books out there that sort of don't take that point of view. But for me, I believe that was everything that he was about. He even claims in his letters that he doesn't eat people. He doesn't eat brains. He doesn't do any of the stuff that is talked about. He did this for the pure fact of being put back into an insane asylum. He hated where he was, and he wanted to be moved, and he thought this was the only way it was going to happen. And this is proof positive. Since he's still been in all these years, he's never ever done anything like this again, and he's never ever had that inclination to do this. Of course, he's in solitary, and he's in that special cell that you see in the movie. But he's never, ever done this kind of act since.
Well, it's kind of hard to when you're locked away like Hannibal Lecter in a bulletproof, you know, Magneto-like cell to be kept away from the general population.
Well, yes and no. And the big difference is when you see the cell like Hannibal in the movie, that is fairly true, except for there's actually two cells in the basement of Wakefield, exactly the same. So he's side by side with someone else that's classified in the same place as him. So he's been placed in that at the end of Murder Row, they call it, with one other person that's considered the worst. The two worst people in the whole prison are there, and he's always one. And what I did was actually in the book, the last chapters are dedicated to a lot of the other real famous killers, such as Charles Bronson, who's known for their murders and their rampages, and how much all of them are totally petrified of this little skinny guy named Robert Maudsley. And it's really quite amusing, I think, at times when you read some of these other just outrageous killers and about how terrified just being in a prison cell for a few months beside this guy and talking to him and how he's able to terrify some of these huge, massive killers. I think it's...
Does he work like Hannibal Lecter? Does he sit there and continually dig at the psyche of the people that share cells near him?
Yes and no. The Hannibal that they present in the movies and even the other books is very intelligent in a different way than this Hannibal. This Hannibal's smart and well-spoken, very well-read, but he doesn't do that sort of, he does work on the psyche of other prisoners, but he does it in a very light way. He doesn't do it in such a complicated way as Hannibal on TV does. I don't know if that makes sense.
Gotcha.
He's able to pick up things from people. He's very observant. He's able to pick up movements, certain gestures, certain things that other prisoners say. He also understands why they've been put in. And he kind of will, he does this analysis of the person, and therefore he knows what buttons to push. But it's not very it's not like a complicated, and he doesn't do the Chianti and all that sort of,
No Chianti like, and fava beans?
Yeah, no, he's not like that. He's more
about
of
toilet
a,
gin. Toilet
yeah,
gin? Is that?
Yeah. So he would, like, for instance, if you were in the cell beside him, he would pick out things. He would learn things about you. And he would know what to say and do to put you in a dark place. And that's what kind of turned him on. He wanted to bring you back to the bad place that you sit in, and he likes that. He likes making you feel dark, and I think that's, you get that in his letters, you get that in his behavior, and you even get that in the general group on his website. He wants to He wants to find out the little things and bring them up in a way that seems really innocent, but, you know, it's not.
That's chilling. But, I mean, it does sound like the real Hannibal Lecter, or not the real, he is the real Hannibal Lecter, but it sounds very much like the movie iterations of Hannibal Lecter, the way he, the psychology of it all, and getting into the heads of these people to just mess with them and prove that he's kind of the superior and digging at those weak spots.
Yeah. And I think, well, in essence, what he's done is he's learned his own strength. He's learned from that brain eating incident how much that changed his life in prison and how much people fear him. And so I think what he's done is he's learned the power of the word, the power of thought and reading, and kind of getting into people that way. Because the reality is, you look at him, he's skinny, and he's not a big man, and he's not a terrifying looking man. And you're sitting beside someone like Charles Bronson, who's murdered several, and he looks like, you know, Hulk, and how you can take that situation and turn it around. He that's where his intelligence and his clever lies. And like I said, and, you know, he's just a read person, as in he reads. He's not an educated person. He didn't even go to high school. So it's the power of learning through books.
How forthcoming has he been about his life, and how much do you believe of his claims as being the real thing?
You know, I'm almost in the part of believing everything that he claims. I really do, because your actions kind of speak louder than your words in a lot of cases. Like, you know, people can say things, but you look at what their movements are. His movements are very, very, how do you say, like, he reacted to the pictures of children being abused because he was, you know, he really, you know, his claim of his dad beating him with a .22 caliber and with poles and doing some really nasty things to him, including raping him with a gun and things like that. So a lot of his claims were very personal to him, and I think they're very real. Of course, we can't prove any of this. This is all too long ago, but his reactions to it at a very young age make me believe they're real, and it's very, you can almost see how it grew and where he went and what he, you know, he probably had to do a lot of things to avoid his father's abuse. And I think that's where he learned the manipulation at a very young age, and was on the street, you know, by 16 as a male prostitute and a drug addict. It's not like a big concept plan. It's very reactive, and he's learned from those reactions, and he kept on progressing, and to where he did this brain eating display for something. He was trying to get something, and I don't think he got what he wanted. And so, but he's learned from those actions and reactions how to keep on going further and get what he wants. And now he's in a prime place, so to speak.
Talk to us now. Wakefield Prison, I know, has been referred to as Monster Mansion, right?
Right.
Because of the kind of people that are there. What can you tell us about, you know, the other criminals? And is there anything so different than you'd find in any American prison? Or is this pretty interesting? Is this kind of the Arkham Asylum of the planet, a real place with complete lunatics?
Well, this is a place with complete lunatics. This was the worst of the worst. If you have a Wakefield prison attached to your name, in the UK, you are considered a complete psycho savage. Like, you were the worst of the worst, you know, like Ian Brady and all of these people that were known for being you know, and doing the most savage style murders as well. How do you say, not regular murders. In the States, it's very, you know, the prisons are privatized, so they vary state to state and who's in them and how they go about and conduct the prison is different. In the UK, they have levels, and this is like a, because it's government, it is a complete AA level. So you have to be a bad killer of a killer to be put in here. So this is not a typical prison. And this is really the only one the UK has.
The other couple of prisoners, you said there were a couple others. What would you say, Charles Bronson?
Yeah, Charles Bronson.
Okay, not the actor, folks. Charles
Bronson.
No. Killer.
No. No, his name's Salvador. And what he did was he changed his name because he liked Charles Bronson in movies so much. He's been incarcerated for over 44 years. And this guy is really popular in the UK because what he does is he marries really famous people. He married like a Paula Williamson, and she was like known for her, her body and what she's kind of a reality star, but at the same time, all of a sudden she turns up dead. This guy can have his own book. And, this guy actually, when he, killed the guard, Charles Bronson did, he, when he got put on trial for that, he called, Hannibal Cannibal, Robert Bodsley, to be one of his witnesses. He's that kind of person.
What do you mean, to be one of his witnesses to what? His lunacy?
Yeah, because he wanted to say that they get treated so badly by the guards there, that was his defense. And Bodsley could testify to this about how badly they're treated. Like, it's just, but
our crimes are so heinous because of the way we're treated. Is he trying to put that on? I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. No, and I think the reality is Charles Bronson wants to entertain people. He wants to make the news. He's kind of like a Jodi Arias in a sense. You know, over there, he's kind of their entertaining prisoner that's always creating a drama just to be put on TV and to have people talk about it, you know? So I think that's where that's why he's pulling in people like Maudsley, because it just, wouldn't you watch, you know, they televised this stuff. Wouldn't you want to watch that? Right.
Yeah.
This is fun. You know, it's kind of a joke in a sense, because no matter what, there are people that are never going to get out of prison. But there are also people, because we don't, you know, we don't kill anymore in the UK, that they're never going to be terminated. They're just going to keep on doing this thing, to stay relative, relevant, I guess.
Right. Now, when did Bronson, when was his kind of, career path set?
Well, Bronson's making the news, since the 80s.
Okay.
You know, he's been killing and raping and torturing people on and off for years, and he's a very he's got a lot of charisma, and he's a very entertaining character. That's the best way I can say it. He is he's not scared of being on TV, and he handles himself quite well, like a professional.
No,
I should be his agent.
Right. Maudsley was put in prison when?
Maudsley actually, that was 1974 was the murder that he committed and was put in originally for. He actually is the longest serving lifer in the UK now that Ian Brady has died, you know, from the Moors murder. Ian Brady was the longest. But now Maudsley has that reputation as well to add to his belt.
And so he's still alive, Maudsley?
Yes. Okay. Yes. And he's got it, like, you can join his group and be in support of him.
Huh.
His group His group has 50,000 people in it.
Wow.
And they support him and his efforts to bring civilization to prisons, to bring back. He wants more cable. He wants televisions. He wants fresh fruit. He has a big list of grievances, and you can join his group and be in support. Maybe donate some money.
You know what? I'll tell you what. Tim has the bigger heart of the two of us, so maybe I'll just let Tim join that group and send some money.
Nice. And he's quite a bit wealthier, I know.
Quite a bit. But in radio, that's only separated by $4 or $5.
Yeah.
That's the drive-through or big meal.
Now, do you know, like, Dr. Death, I guess he's out there at that same prison. Do you know much about these other kind of players that
are Harold Sharpman. What I've done is I've included them in, like, Dr. Death and some of the other big ones are in the book, and I kind of give a rundown. My perspective is more about them as prisoners and how they conduct themselves in prison and how they interacted with Maudsley. Because, Yorkshire Ripper, Peter Sutcliffe, we had there's quite a few other big celebrity, as you want to call them, criminals in there. And they've all had to sit beside him for either maybe a week to as much as a year. And it's just kind of it kind of explains most of them, what their interaction is. And I've got a list of, I think, about 12 of them. And every single one of them is by after their meeting with Maudsley at the end of it, they're either terrified of him, very cautious of him, depending on the person who it is. Bronson is probably the only one that's not scared of him, but very cautious of him. So he has a way of really terrifying some of the worst people in the world.
That is crazy that he's able to do that and do it so effectively. You know, it makes you wonder if there is something supernatural about someone like that, that they have that kind of ability.
I think so. And I think that it's representative of the mind. You think about how strong the mind is, and the mind can create a lot of things, including illusions and you look at how people follow people. You look at how rock stars or movie stars can ebb and flow and how they can get all these huge followers, the people clamoring and crying and screaming, you know, outside of their hotel and stuff. It's kind of the same thing. It's not necessarily always a good thing. And it's not always a good thing that they're doing. It's just how they can work the mind and how deep they get into it. And after Maudsley, I question a lot of things that we take for granted and a lot of things that we think are paranormal. And I just question a lot more than I used to from this perspective. He gives you a different perspective because he creates a reality for these other people that doesn't really exist. But he's created it so well, he's got their minds believing it. So, and I think that is representative to when, like when you go out even on your haunted cases and stuff, you got to be very careful about what is created in your mind and what is real. And that's probably the hardest thing to do in your job.
It is to a degree. Alan, did you have a chance to try to reach out to Maudsley? Was that even something you wanted to do?
Yeah, I've got two letters from him. That's actually why I've been used in this British series so much. This is the fifth book in it, because I've had what I do is I have a person that was in prison in Wakefield for a very long time, and he is my contact, and he's put me in touch with other prisoners. So I spoke with a few of them. So like the Grinder serial killer, Stephen Port, and even Ian Brady, I've got, I think I have 10 letters from Ian Brady from the Moores murders and now Maudsley. So it's kind of my way of connecting to these people and getting their perspective on life, really.
How does Maudsley respond to you? I mean, does he realize you were writing a book about him?
No, with Maudsley, he doesn't. So he's probably going to eat me. No, with Port and Brady, I had conversations with, so that was different. With Maudsley, no. Maudsley was a completely secondhand, and that's why I didn't put the letters in the book. And the other books, I put in samples of the letters from each of the killers and the interactions from them. Whereas this one I didn't, because that's just it's a secondhand, so I didn't think it would be appropriate. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's kind of what I thought. I thought, well, so he's very, he's a very well-spoken and he's a very smart person. It's the best way I can say. His letters are well-structured. He's a good writer. And he's well thought out. He's very planned in his thinking. There's no loose talking with Maudsley.
Is it kind of strange to get letters from these brutal killers? I mean, what's that like on your end?
You know, I guess it is. I used to say no, and I used to say that for years. And now that I kind of look at how I am, I've realized looking back that it has caused some effect in my behavior. It does affect me. But I didn't realize it at the time. I think probably this last one, because outside of this book, because I've been working on that David Shearing, who killed 7 people, and I just spent a month with him in prison. And I come out of that different. That's the best way I can say it. Things are different.
Yeah, not so, like you want to eat Tim or I different, right?
No. If anything, I think I no. Well, maybe.
Go with Tim. He's better at being told.
Yeah, he's not as tough.
I've got too much gristle on me, Alan. I'd say Dave. Yeah, go with Dave.
Come on, Rob, barbecued. No, I think what it does is, I mean, what it does is it changes how you meet people and how you interact with people. And it changes my perspective on when people are say and do things, especially like on social media, you know, how you get all sorts of nutty stuff. I think what it does is it just sort of, it takes away the edge. I've just noticed certain things different. And I think it's not only meeting the killer, it's also meeting a lot of the families that have been affected by it and seeing how they are years and years later and seeing how much it's still a very big part of their life, and it doesn't ever close. Even though people like to say there's closure, I don't think so. It just changes. But anyway, you absorb a lot of that, and then it kind of comes out later, is the best way to say it. So, yeah. So it has an effect. I used to always say it didn't.
Do you ever think, you know, maybe it's time to step away and start writing about kittens and puppies for a while?
All the time. And yeah. I keep on saying that. But, you know, the thing is, I keep saying that, well, this will be the last book. I'll go into something different. And it just doesn't. And I've always, you see, because you've always got 2 or 3 books going. And right now I've got that other serial killer book going. And I've got a... I'm writing about cults, and I've got a book about Satan that I'm 3/4 of the way through. And the thing is, I feel obligated because, like, for instance, with the Church of Satan, they've given me unlimited access. They've given me so much information and so much about what goes on in their church and about their members and people that I feel very obligated and I've invested so much time. So to walk away now would be very, I don't feel it would be good. You know, I think it's too important to finish.
That's why we love you. You put yourself into these projects and really, you know, dig deep to get to the balance and understanding. When you were getting letters from Maudsley, I mean, were they just, was there ever a threatening undertone? Do you ever see him trying to come up over the top and manipulate you in any way?
No, actually none of them. The very few that do, it's more about, you know, like with Stephen Port, the Grinder Killer, it's more about, they sure have terrible food, or they've run out of their money for, to buy certain treats, and the food's so bad, or the, you know, they can't make phone calls, or they can't, you know, it's always an issue that they have where they're at, and they're always looking for some sort of support. You know, it's about money. Their manipulation is more about what they can get from you and then they can give you, you know, it's really kind of that for them. That's all I've come across so far. Except for this other one too, that I've just done, in prison, because he's going up for parole. And so it's very important that I do something for him that's good. So it's more about trying to manipulate what I'm going to write about him.
Gotcha. Them, you know, trying to have that control over you.
Yeah,
you,
and
once your books come out, do you ever get letters threatening, you know, hey, I don't like the way you portrayed me?
Yeah, probably the worst ones was the Moores murder, as in threatening, because in the Moores murders, one of the boys was never found. That Ian Brady and that they had killed and raped and buried. They never did find that body. And so they've always looked. And so with that particular case, I talked to the mother of that boy, because she's constantly going out and searching for him. And they're doing digs through the moors trying to find the body. And they never did. And she passed away, actually. But before she did, they had a memorial for the son. And I wrote about that. I wrote about it. Started out with her and how she would stay up all night and how little noises would always make her twitch. And she was, so I really described that a whole lot. And I didn't know at the time, but there was another boy. He had a brother. And this brother had gone insane, had been in and out of institutions. And when the book came out and I wrote about that, he was really, really upset because he thought that I made his mother look weak.
Ooh.
And I really didn't. I thought it showed an extreme amount of power. This woman for what, 25 years, never stopped looking and digging and trying to find the body of her son. She never quit. I never looked at her as weak. I thought she was an incredibly strong woman to go through all of that. And he thought I was making her look weak, and that was never my intention. My intention was to show you how much she cared and how much she devoted all of her life to trying to find her son's body and put some sort of a closure to that. And but he was pretty outraged at it. So yeah, it can be devastating, because you know, that's the last thing you expect,
right?
You know, well, especially when it comes from a family member, it hurts a lot, as compared to it coming from the killer, which sounds weird because you should be scared of the killer. But I think you don't do these books. I don't do these books in any intention of hurting anybody in the family. It actually is really hard when that happens, because you kind of go, oh, man, that's the last thing I wanted. But it happens.
Well, Alan, as always, it is a pleasure to catch up with you. And as the new books come out, I know we'll be visiting with you again, sir. Thank you for all that you do and for bringing the stories out. And please remember to take care of yourself, buddy. I know this can be a heavy weight and burden, hearing all of this darkness and having it surround your life. So make sure you're taking time for you as well, all right?
I try.
All right, buddy.
Well, thank you.
Keep in touch and let me know when the new books are out. Would you do that?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
All right. Fantastic. Hey, kids, guess what? Time to lighten the load a little bit. We're going to kick open the case files. It's time now for Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right. Now, before we get into Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals, make sure that you click the link to go buy Alan Warren's book that'll be out later this month. You can pre-order it and get a copy. And do me a favor, if you want to get copies of any of the books you hear on Beyond the Darkness or here on True Crime Tuesday, go to darknessradio.com, click on the storefront, and then click on my Amazon page. There you'll find all of the books. We're trying to collect everything in one place so that you can find all the books. And I've broken them up into sections: paranormal books, true crime books, paranormal swag and gifts and things to watch. So you can see all those different categories. Go in there and you're going to find the books that we talk about on the show, the movies, documentaries, DVDs, and more. So go get it and take a look at it. Darknessradio.com. Click on the store tab for more information. All right, Tim, before we get into Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals, I want to talk to you about an interesting story and get your take on this.
Okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right, here's the story coming to us from Des Moines, Iowa, Tim. Des Moines.
Ah, yes.
Des Moines, Iowa. An Iowa inmate serving a life sentence. Tim, now what does that mean to you when I say somebody serves a life sentence? That means they're in until?
Until they die.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
An Iowa inmate serving a life sentence says he should now be a free man because he became ill, momentarily died, and had to be revived at the hospital. Benjamin Schreiber was sentenced to life in prison without parole in 1997 after being convicted of first-degree murder. In March 2015, he developed large kidney stones that led to septic poisoning, according to court documents. He eventually fell unconscious in his cell, was taken to a local hospital, where he died. Not once, not twice, not even three times a lady, but five separate times he died and was resuscitated, according to the official documents. According to the Iowa Court of Appeals, Schreiber claims he died at the hospital, thereby fulfilling his life sentence. Because his sentence has been fulfilled, he argues, he is imprisoned illegally and should be immediately released. A district court previously denied Schreiber's motion, and on Wednesday, the Iowa Court of Appeals upheld the lower court's decision. In its opinion, the appeals court said a plain reading of Iowa law says defendant guilty of a Class A felony must spend the rest of their natural life in prison, regardless of how long that period of time ends up being or any events occurring before the defendant's life ends. Schreiber is either alive, in which case he must remain in prison, Judge Amanda Potterfield wrote, or he is dead, in which case this appeal is moot. An attorney for Schreiber did not immediately respond to requests for comment. It's unclear whether Schreiber plans to take the case to a higher court. So if your job is to be put in jail until death, and you die not once but five times and have to be revived. Now, the old law, if I remember correctly, Tim, was if they hung you and you survived the hanging,
mm-hmm.
like the rope broke, you know, those things, that you kind of they considered that God's will, and you're on your own. You know, you could be free again. But what do you think of this? Should somebody who died and then had to be revived be considered, you know, a second life? I don't know. How do you look at it? I mean, obviously, I know I'm pissing a lot of people off by even bringing the subject up, but it's just an interesting, I thought, talking point of what is considered a life sentence until you die. He died five times.
Well, obviously,
you see a possibility for a loophole. I mean, should they at least examine that concept and change the laws going forward?
Obviously, he wasn't trying too hard to die. He came back five times.
But he had to be brought back.
Well,
he that's kind of the deal, too. You wonder if he would have been better off just letting himself go.
Here's the thing, though. Was he ever officially called by the doctor? Like, was time of death called?
Well, no, because they resuscitate. Yeah,
right. But did he come back after they had tried to call him? That's the thing. If he had been called in there, or they thought about calling him and then he came back, I could see where there's a case. But if it was a case of, you know, they kept bringing him back, I don't know. The letter of the law in Iowa, the way it's written, is pretty cut and dried. You know, you're
right
until the end of your natural life.
Right.
Well,
but now it's a supernatural life because he's been dead and come back. <Da-da-da>.
I see where you're going with it, but the way they state it, there could be interruptions in that life. However, you're still alive, and that's what the prosecution is going to come at him with. Now he could state, well, had it not been interrupted by a doctor, it would have ended. So therefore, because it was interrupted by a doctor, I should be dead.
I'm backing up because I'm sensing the arrival of Tim Dennis, defense attorney at law.
if it weren't for a doctor, it would have ended naturally.
It's like my law clerk, Tim, is stepping up. I like this.
So therefore, had a doctor not stepped in,
right,
I would be dead. And,
right.
And therefore, in the eyes, even though in the eyes of the law, you're saying my life continues, really, my life wouldn't have continued had it not been for medical personnel.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Dennis and Schrader, defense attorneys at law. We're fighting on the side of right or whoever pays us.
So really, this, I like it. So really, this is technically a new life, and in that new life, wouldn't you want to turn over a new cheek, or you know, turn the
new cheek,
a butt cheek.
I want to turn over a new cheek,
Turn over a new leaf, a new cheek, a new whatever, you know, squeak a cheek, whatever it is, the saying,
squeak a cheek,
or leave a penny, take a penny. I don't remember how this goes, Dave. This is why we let you do the deliberations.
But now people know they've got both of us side of the bench, Tim.
So I mean, there is a little bit of leeway there, but really you would have to have, depending on if you put it in front of a judge or a jury, obviously, if you bring it in front of a circuit court judge to review it, they're going to say no, that it's the letter of the law is clear that you have no ground to stand on. Your life has just been interrupted and not stopped and started. But
you know, I wonder, I'm surprised that, like, as a prisoner, he didn't sign a DNR, do not resuscitate. Because honestly, if you get sick to the point where they have to resuscitate you and bring you back, wouldn't you rather just be let go?
But see, as a prisoner, you don't have those rights. As a prisoner, you're a ward of the state. So they decide whether they keep you alive or let you go.
Craziness.
Yeah.
All right. Here's another story for the headlines, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to Denver. Mile High, Tim. Mile High Club in this case.
Ah, yes.
At least 10 people have been left to believe they are half siblings with the same donor. Sperm donor, that is.
Uh-oh.
Dr. Paul Jones, I wanted to know my health history, Shauna Holtz said. I'm super into genealogy, Maya Emmons Boring said. I was really interested in the health side of things, Crystal McFeeters had to add. Three strangers with similar curiosity did what millions have done, a DNA test with Ancestry.com or 23andMe. However, the results traced back to one man. There's no one else on the planet that can relate to our exact situations, Emmons Boring said. After all this, we have 10 half-siblings that we are aware of at this time, ranging from 1978 to 1997, Holtz said. Almost a dozen strangers across the country are related to a fertility doctor in Grand Junction and Women's Healthcare of Western Colorado. Each of the siblings was coming forward, and we all have the same story, Holtz said. My mom went to Dr. Jones. My mom went to Dr. Jones. You start to think in the back of your mind, after 10 Dr. Joneses, there's something going on here. The siblings say Jones helped their mothers conceive. Literally, Tim. He was the big doctor in town in a small community, Charlene Madsen said. Madsen went to Jones for artificial insemination. I was under the impression that it was an anonymous donor, Madsen said. Oh, under the impression. I wonder what the documents say. If you're just going in for a cup of man batter, then you're not being pacific about it, Tim. Pacific, I say.
Yep.
Right? I mean, here's the deal. He's probably thinking, look at me. I'm a good looking fella. I'm a doctor. Yeah. Who wouldn't want a little cup of my joy juice? Think of the great children I could create.
A cup so of joy juice?
So if they were specific, right, if they were just looking for, you know, some man cake batter.
Man cake batter.
I wonder where, it's interesting. Madsen went to Jones for artificial insemination. I was under impression that it would be an anonymous donor. Well, it was. He didn't tell you whose it was. He anonymously donated his sperm into your vagina.
Wow.
Emmons Boring's mom, who is suing Jones, claims he told her the same thing. He explained that it would be like a medical student or a law student in the area that they would use, Emmons Boring said. Well, it was a doctor. I'd rather have a doctor than a student. I mean, Tim, if I had to have some man's batter put in me, I would choose a doctor.
Well, thank God you don't have to.
However, this year, Emmons Boring believes she identified Jones as the donor in at least 10 cases. On January 24th, I linked some paternal second cousins to Jones's mother, Emmons Boring said. Then when Maya said, hey, I did this genealogy thing and it comes back to him, I felt angry and I felt sick to my stomach, McFeeters said. It was just a shocking blow. On November 1st, Jones voluntarily surrendered his medical license. He denies allegations that he used his own fresh sperm to impregnate. And these are in quotes, fresh sperm to impregnate multiple patients. So was he using his stale sperm?
Oh, maybe. Maybe it was just sitting around on a shelf somewhere.
I personally hope he has to publicly open up about what he did, Emmons Boring said. Emmons Boring and her family filed a lawsuit against Jones and Women's Healthcare of Western Colorado. Other siblings say they plan to do the same. I want to know his health history. I want to know why, and I want legislation preventing this from happening to anybody else, Holtz said. Jones did not respond to request for comment. And apparently his wrist hurt too much to write something.
Oh, God.
It's a lot of stirring of the man better there, Tim.
Well, it is. Yeah. It's
as long as we're talking doctors, let's go to Chesapeake, Virginia. Or is that Chesapeake, Tim? A Virginia doctor has been arrested after he was accused of performing hysterectomies and other unnecessary medical procedures on patients without their consent, according to a federal affidavit. The affidavit said in an investigation to Javid Paraways, 69, was launched in September of 2018 after the FBI received a tip from a hospital employee that the doctor may be performing unnecessary surgeries on patients. According to the affidavit, one patient was told by Paraways in 2012 that precancerous cells had been detected during an exam and that a hysterectomy would be the best course of action. The patient wanted a less invasive procedure and thought that they had agreed on a laparoscopic surgery to remove the ovaries. Instead, when she woke up, she found out Paraways had performed a total abdominal hysterectomy and had perforated her bladder in the process, which caused her to develop sepsis and be hospitalized for 6 days. A hysterectomy is the surgical removal of a woman's uterus, which is where a fetus grows when a woman is pregnant. Sometimes the cervix, ovaries, and fallopian tubes are also removed. Okay. Hysterectomies are very common, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which says that about 33% of women in the United States have had one by age 60. Wow, 33% of women. Yeah. I did not know that.
Yeah, it's pretty high. It's a pretty high percentage.
Wow. Yikes.
Yeah.
The doctor faces charges of health fraud and making false statements relating to healthcare matters, according to the affidavit. He is being held without bail until his detention hearing later this week. In order to help earn money while in jail, he has decided to donate sperm, Tim. No, I hope not.
No.
Crazy. How do you just, you know what, as long as I'm in here, I might as well just take the uterus.
You know, I hate to say this, and it, you know, it comes from the, it comes from the being on the opposite side of the fence, I guess, but guys can look at it and just think, you know, oh, it's just, we're just going to rip the parts out, no big deal.
The parts out? Oh my God, yikes.
No, it seriously, if you've never lived on that side, you'd have no idea what kind of a procedure it is and how devastating it is. But it's right. A devastating procedure.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Police officer suspended from work after he was caught on camera dancing naked at a club. I don't know that I could call this dancing. Lumbering, falling, barely standing up straight. That seems to be much more fitting. Little Rock, Arkansas. A police officer from Arkansas is off the job for a month only, Tim, after he was caught on camera dancing naked at a nightclub last month.
Oh, no.
I got to tell you, Tim, it gets hot in those nightclubs.
It can. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If the air conditioning's not on, it's kind of their fault.
Oh, no.
According to KATV, Tim, KATV. Or Cat V.
Yeah, Cat
Officer V. Sebron Hackett was suspended without pay for 30 days in order to complete remedial training. How does remedial police training help you to not dance naked?
Well, they take a nightstick and then they put you in handcuffs and they have you hold your hands out and they whack your hands with the nightstick until you stop getting naked in clubs.
I guess.
That's how it works.
He was reportedly off duty, appeared to be highly intoxicated when he took his clothes off at the club and started dancing. I got to guess, isn't that like ecstasy and Molly? Doesn't that make you burn up and you want to take your clothes off?
I wouldn't know that firsthand, Dave.
Liar.
Wouldn't know firsthand, but...
That's why they used to call you old Molly Dennis in college.
No, it was because I would wear a wig and a dress out to the clubs on weekends.
Tim Ecstasy Dennis. Your actions have brought discredit and embarrassment upon the Conway Police Department and could have resulted in your public arrest for public intoxication, the letter from Chief Jody Spradlin said. In the video released to the TV outlet, Hackett is also seen pushing away a security guard, stumbling onto the floor. He's then escorted away from the crowd while still naked. Officers from Little Rock Police Department were working as security guards at the time, and they said they did not know Hackett was a cop. Officers used discretion at the time not to arrest the subject for misdemeanor offense due to his cooperation, and an acquaintance said that they would be responsible for the subject, the Little Rock Police Department said. See, I wonder if somebody slipped him a roofie. Could be. That would be Dave Schrader, defense attorney at law's case. Apparently some perp in here recognized me as a cop, doped up my drink. Bam. You know, I'm starting to realize I just kind of sound like a liar as a defense attorney, Tim.
Yeah, a little bit. Well, what would be the point, though, of putting some Molly in a cop's drink other than to watch him?
Right, to do that, just that. Embarrass the hell out of himself and look like an asshole. You don't think that would be enough of an instigation for some jackass?
No. Not unless he sent you to jail for something. I mean,
yeah. Well, that's maybe he gave you a ticket because, you know, and you didn't have money that week. I don't know. But you got money for a roofie. Who knows?
Yeah,
how much is a roofie nowadays, Tim? How much do you charge?
I have no idea, Dave. I don't spend money on stuff like that. I have no idea.
Loveland is paying $50,000 and drops charges against a woman who has issued a summons for playing Frisbee topless. Loveland, Colorado, the city of Loveland agreed to pay a woman $50,000 and drop all charges against her after she was accused of indecent exposure for playing Frisbee topless in her front yard. Attorney David Lane says his client, 20-year-old Efrosini Krokos, they call her Effie, received a ticket after playing Frisbee in her yard with her husband. On September 26th, her breasts were exposed. Lane says in February 2019, the 10th Circuit of Appeals decided a case called the Free the Nipple versus the City of Fort Collins. That's truly the case called, Tim.
Yeah.
Free the Nipple.
You've never heard of that before?
No.
Free the Nipple? No.
Versus City of Fort Collins. According to Lane, the court found it is legal for women to appear topless at any place. It would be legal for a man to appear topless.
Yep.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I love American justice, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Grokos read about the case in the media, and when she saw her husband had removed his shirt, she did the same. Scandalized neighbors called the police, and an officer came out and issued her a summons, Tim.
There's a there's a free the nipple movement out there, Dave.
That's crazy. Yeah. How do I sign on?
Well, you just...
I want you to know I'm doing this show topless right now, as is Tim.
I am, yeah.
We've been a part of the Free the Nipple group for quite a while. The officer reportedly told Grokos that the Fort Collins case was a rumor and it did not apply to Loveland. If convicted, Ms. Grokos would have had to register as a sex offender. And she was under a great deal of stress as a result, Lane said. The $50,000 settlement is the first damage claim paid to a woman wrongfully charged for being topless in the United States. I will tell you, I've seen guys out there without their shirts on at the state fair and at the pool whose boobs are bigger than half the women I know.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And should probably pay damages to most of us for doing so. Yeah. Yeah.
In a statement, the city of Loveland said it reached the settlement with Grokos after consulting with its insurance provider. Additionally, the city said its officer followed proper protocols in accordance with local law. The woman was cited for exposing her breasts in violation of a city ordinance that prohibits such exposure in or near any public place or in any place open to public view. The city statement read. Loveland says it has suspended enforcement of the law and will recommend that city council review it. The nipples are about to be free. Drugs and nipples in Colorado, Tim.
Yeah. The Free the Nipple movement simply believes that breasts have been sexualized for way too long and that women have the same rights to take their shirts off as men do.
All right. Let's power through this. In Iowa, fire chief, Tim. Another story from Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
Florida's flying under the radar this week, Tim.
They are.
Iowa fire chief accused of driving an ambulance while intoxicated. Grand Junction, Iowa. The Grand Junction fire chief is accused of driving a patient to the hospital while intoxicated. Thomas Lauderville is charged with operating while intoxicated. The police report shows a sergeant with the Jefferson Police Department noticed Lauderville slurring his words over the radio.
Careful, buddies. I got a bleeder in the ear coming in hot. Coming in looking for a little DOC on the ASAP.
That's what the audio sounds like, Tim.
Wow.
Yeah. Sergeant Shane Jones said when he arrived at the Greene County Medical Center, Lauderville smelled of alcohol and was unsteady on his feet. Lauderville told police he had 3 to 4 beers, but he refused to take a field sobriety test. He was arrested, and a breath test placed his blood alcohol level at 0.21, triple the legal limit of 0.08. This is his second OWI.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
I don't know that I want that ride to the hospital.
I don't know that I even want to read this story. I just love the headline. Oak Creek police investigate the case of two men and a chicken swerving all over the roadway.
Hmm.
Was the chicken trying to cross the road and the two men were trying to hit it, Tim? Let's find out.
Okay.
Oak Creek is the site of the story. It may be the strangest game of chicken Oak Creek police have ever seen. A man and his chicken were locked up in the back of a squad car after they found by police after another driver called foul, telling 911 operators they saw a bird or a hawk on the shoulder or arm of the driver while he was driving and traveling approximately 20 to 30 miles per hour, swerving all over the roadway. Police stopped the vehicle. They found two men, a bird, and I know this can be hard to believe, Tim, and a lot of booze, including 6 open Bud Light cans. That poor bird was hammered. Or is this one of those beer chickens, Tim? Did they get this wrong? They thought that you feed the chicken beer and then cook it?
It could be, yeah, to help take some of the pain away, I guess. Yeah.
Including 6 open Bud Light cans and 3 open Modelo bottles of beer.
Hmm.
And an 18-pack of Modelo and a 30-pack of Bud Light sitting in the back seat.
Damn.
Yeah. The guy with the chicken was the passenger. He was cited for open intoxicants. The driver got his own ride to the lockup and is facing a more serious punishment. Police say his license was revoked at the time because of past OWIs. As for the chicken, it's now in the care of the Milwaukee Area Domestic Animal Control Commission and is expected to be just fine. And Tim, I think you should adopt that chicken. That chicken needs your love.
Well, there's no guarantee if it comes to my house, it won't be battered and fried. I'm just saying.
Timothy.
I'm just saying.
Timothy.
Unless I give it some E and we go dancing out in the middle of the street naked.
All right. A little chicken on E,
yeah.
You get chicken strung out on booze and alcohol. Tim, let me just give you a bit of advice. Mm-hmm. If you decide your times are tough.
Yeah.
Love is not enough and you want to break into a home, don't do it in Michigan.
Okay.
Michigan man whose hobbies include ritualized combat with replica weapons from the Middle Ages says he wielded a battle axe as he called his baby to fend off an intruder. Oh, his battle axe he calls baby. 36-year-old Ben Ball tells WOOD, Tim, the wood.
The wood.
Get it every night. Wood TV. He was playing video games at his apartment in Oshtemo Township, about 130 miles west of Detroit, late Wednesday when someone who once dated his ex-roommate kicked in the door. He believed the attacker might be armed. Ball also tells the station he grabbed the axe.
Bet he
That's
did.
That's what the wood likes to hear.
Yeah.
When a man jumps up and grabs the axe,
mm-hmm.
took two steps forward and struck the intruder in the torso. After the two grappled, the attacker fled. Police deployed a canine unit to track a trail of blood leading to 33-year-old Alex Lavelle Rawls. Wow. Kalamazoo County officials say Rawls spent the night at a hospital before going to jail. That's what the wood has to report, Tim. Rawls faces a home invasion charge. How? That is like the wrong house to break into. The guy... He pulls out Baby the battle axe. First of all, how handy is Baby?
Yeah, really.
That you just sitting there, you know, is it at your feet on the ground next to your pint of ale?
I got to think so, yeah. And the chamber pot, yeah.
Yes, chamber pot? Good God.
Yeah.
Oh, damn it, Florida. We thought you were going to be smart, but, you know, you couldn't stay off. Sarasota, Florida weighs in now, Tim. Or Tim. Time.
Well, it's the old E next to the time, Tim. Yeah.
It's like about the mead and the spittoon
right.
chamber pot.
The chamber pot.
Ye old time Dennis.
Ye old time Dennis, yeah.
Sometimes it's best to keep your Facebook comments to yourself, Tim.
Oh, okay.
When two men stole more than $1,000 worth of merch from Walmart, the DeSoto County Sheriff's Office shared the mugshots of the two suspects. Then one of the suspects, Cody Pierce, decided to share his thoughts. First off, I have money and it's all legit, Pierce wrote in Facebook. He goes on to say he has a lawyer who is very hungry for a case of slander and defamation of character, and then continues with, now I would appreciate you removing my picture, Pierce said. Fortunately, the DeSoto County Sheriff's Office is very understanding. If you would like to come on by the sheriff's office, we'll be glad to remove your current photo and replace it with your booking photo, the sheriff's office replied. True to their word, the sheriff's office shared the booking photo of Cody. It wasn't me, Pierce. It wasn't me. As they called him on Wednesday after he was arrested, Pierce is accused of stealing the merchandise from a DeSoto County Walmart on October 27th, along with Michael Meacham of Arcadia. Meacham was found and arrested prior to the initial Facebook post. After arresting Pierce, the officer's sheriff's office also showed a blurry photo of a tattoo alongside a photo of Pierce's leg tattoo to emphasize the similarities.
Hmm.
Huh. All right, Tim, our last couple of stories. Two accused of putting hallucinogenic drug in vape pens.
Ooh.
Yeah, we're going to Wake Forest, North Carolina, Tim. Two people who are accused of running a drug lab in Wake Forest home were arrested during one of the Wake County Sheriff's Office's largest single-day drug busts. That's what deputies told WTVD, Tim.
The TVID.
Yeah. Benjamin Blake Lumpkin and Daniel Day Hawkins were arrested and faced the following charges. Manufacture of a Schedule 1, maintaining a dwelling, possession of precursors. I'm sorry. There's so many P words in a row, Tim. My mind melted.
Sure.
Possession, precursors, and possession of firearms by a convicted felon. Dimethyltryptophanolipidine, or DMT, was made being made in the house, and Lumpkin and Hawkins were allegedly putting the drugs in vape pens. The bust's total street value, how much do you think it was, Tim? How much do you think these two knuckleheads out of Wake Forest, North Carolina, how much DMT were they able to create? What was the street value?
I'm going to say it wasn't much, maybe $300.
$4 million.
What?
Street DMT. Yeah, you know me. You down with DMT?
Yeah, you know me. For $4 million, really?
Wow. We are in the wrong damn job, Tim. Let's give it up. Hawkins is in the Wake County Justice Center under a $835,000 bond, and Lumpkin is under a $135,000 bond. Given a half an hour and their vape pens back, they could afford to get out, Tim.
I guess.
Wow. Yeah.
$4 million?
Yeah. We're going to North Carolina's weighing heavy in the crowd this week, Tim. Rockingham County, North Carolina, Reidsville man faces charges after he allegedly crashed into a deputy's patrol car and then led the deputy on a chase. The sheriff's office said they found $60,000 worth of cocaine and marijuana in the suspect's vehicle, Tim.
That's it?
At about 8:22 p.m. Wednesday, Rockingham County Deputy Tyler Wiseman was patrolling on Grooms Road when he was hit by a gray 2003 Jeep Grand Cherokee. The deputy and canine Buttercup, who was also in the patrol car, thankfully were not injured. The deputy turned on his emergency lights and siren. It says sire, Tim, but I'm sure they meant siren.
Right.
They weren't going to bring out an L horse to try to stop the Jeep.
No.
But the SUV drove away. Wiseman drove after the SUV. Deputies say the SUV then crashed into a tractor trailer on the US 29 bypass near McWalker Road. The driver of the tractor trailer also not injured. The driver of the SUV, though, who was the only person inside, tried to run down the side of the road. Wiseman ran after the suspect. When he caught up, the sheriff's office says the suspect began fighting him to try to escape. Luckily, a good Samaritan then stopped by to help the deputy. Deputy seized the SUV and found 35 pounds of marijuana worth about $60,000, 2.2 pounds of cocaine worth about $60,000, and $4,500 in cash inside. Blackwell was arrested and charged with assault with a deadly weapon on a law enforcement officer, assault on a government official, resist, delay, and obstruct, flee to elude arrest, reckless driving to endanger, failure to yield, driving while license revoked, hit and run, leaving the scene with property damage, failure to stop for flashing blue lights, and a speed violation. That's a lot on a plate, Tim.
It's a busy guy.
I think
guy.
That the Defense Law Office of Schrader and Dennis will just have to pass on that case as we've got much bigger fish to fry.
I think so, yeah.
The Rockingham County Sheriff's Office said Monday that Blackwell was also charged with felony drug trafficking of marijuana and possession of drug paraphernalia. The Sheriff's Office is consulting with the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration about possible federal charges for cocaine, Tim.
Yeah, yo.
He's currently being held on a $1.7 million secured bond. Hoopy doopy. You hit the cop car. Then hit a tractor trailer. You know, the Good Samaritan stopping by to help the deputy. I've often thought of that as I'm driving on the road and you see those sketchy cars pulled over and the cop has got the gun drawn and he's trying to get the guy out. I've often thought, what if I saw flashes come from that car? Would I do anything? Would I? So I've, many times I've been prepared to go after him or slam into the side of him, Tim.
Yeah.
Would you do that?
No.
No? You just let him go? Shot a cop, you wouldn't go after him?
Here's the thing, though, Dave. What are you going to do?
I'm going to hit him with my car, Tim.
Okay. And then what?
And then I'm going to back up and hit him again.
Okay. And then what?
And then I'm going to sit there and have a smoke because I feel pretty satisfied with my day of heroics, Tim. I'm not even a smoker. All right, let's go with this. Speaking of smoking, Tim, I'm going to send you this guy's mugshot. Might be the best mugshot of the month. We should have a mugshot of the month contest.
This guy would
win it hands down. And you look at his face, and then you see the headline, Georgia man arrested after calling to report stolen marijuana.
Oh, all right, let's see here.
Dante Michael Bellamoli. Look at him. What a high stoner. Bellamoli. He's even got his collar popped. I love the Hamburglar outfit they've got him in, too.
Fort Payne,
Alabama says a Georgia man was arrested after calling 911 for help after his marijuana was allegedly stolen. On November 1st, DeKalb County 911 received a call from Dante Michael Bellamoli at the Mentone Market. According to the report, Bellamoli wanted help from an officer after his joints had allegedly been stolen. The Mentone Police Department and the DeKalb County Sheriff's Office Narcotics and Interdiction Team responded to the call. During the investigation, authorities say that Bellamoli had a cocaine and drug paraphernalia on him as well. Dante Michael Bellamoli, 21, was arrested and charged with possession of a controlled substance, possession of drug paraphernalia, and being a dumbass stoner. While it is very uncommon for someone to call dispatch about their missing marijuana, our dispatchers field all manner of calls, from cows in the roadway to extremely serious incidents and emergencies, said DeKalb County Sheriff Nick Weldon. Thank you for explaining to us what dispatch gets calls on, because I get that. Well, really, dispatch gets calls on extremely serious incidents and emergencies, not just a stoner looking for his weed. Tell me that's not the greatest mugshot of the month, though.
That's pretty darn good. Yeah.
You dudes totally arrested me. Doesn't he look like the Hamburglar's nephew or something? I don't know.
He looks very, very happy.
I want to get one of those shirts. Dude, that is the greatest prison shirt ever. And I love that he's got it like unbuttoned down to his navel, like 1970s style.
I don't even know where you get one of those shirts.
You got apparently in Fort Payne, Alabama, when you're a prisoner, Tim.
You have to travel back to 1982 to find something like that.
Well, speaking of traveling back to 1892, Tim, we'll wrap up with this story. I have one more. Longmont, Colorado. A Longmont woman was arrested after allegedly shooting a crossbow at her neighbor.
No.
No one was injured, but 60-year-old Catherine Cherry was arrested for the incident on Friday. Cherry is facing charges of attempted first-degree assault and felony menacing. What are you in for? Felony menacing? That's just a lamest title ever. Robin Harker, who narrowly escaped being shot, said Cherry has called the Longmont Police Department on her before, accusing her of killing Cherry's daughter, even though Harker says she didn't even know Cherry had a daughter. Harker said when she heard a knock on the front door Friday, she worried Cherry might be outside. Harker said she grabbed a hammer as protection, but she never expected to find her neighbor holding a crossbow. See, it's like the 1890s. This is the battle hammer and your crossbow. What am I? Should somebody show up with like a 20-sided die to see how much damage is about to unfold?
How many hit points
in real-life Dungeons and Dragons battle?
Yeah.
Suddenly, Tim, you hear a knock at the door. Do you answer? Do you drink your flagon of ale, or do you grab your battle hammer in preparation for war?
Hold on, let me shake my die and find out.
Oh, my God. When I opened the door, I see it in her hand, and I just started swinging, Harker said. So Thor and Hawkeye are going at it here, Tim. That's when she shot at me. I'm still very nervous because I don't know if they're going to let her come back or not. So here's the deal. Maybe she found a Dave Schrader, defense attorney at law, taking over here, Tim.
Okay.
Maybe my client found a crossbow in her yard. She just came over to say, hey, is this your crossbow? And then Thor starts swinging old Mjolnir. And she's like, what the hell? So she fires off around just to try to, you know, get this woman to back off with her hammer.
Yeah.
Bang, bang, Maxwell's silver hammer came down upon her head.
Who's?
Guess a lot of people don't know that. The Beatles wrote a song about a serial killer.
Well, who's got a big war hammer sitting around the house anyways?
I don't know. I guess, well, we've already had the one guy broke out his battle axe.
Yeah.
Suddenly, it's like, you know, I don't know, Dungeons and Dragons all over again. Battle axe attacks, war hammer, and then the the crossbow. Either too much damn Walking Dead.
I was going to say, yeah. I don't know. There's a lot of people watching Walking Dead these days, aren't there?
Yeah. Hey, by the way, it's not the first time that Cherry has been charged with felony menacing. She was arrested for the same crime several years ago. She pleaded guilty to obstruction of government operations and was sentenced to probation.
So did it say whether she knew how to use the crossbow? Like, did she come close to winging this person?
I don't know. She did, because the Thor started swinging her hammer, and then the crossbow went off.
Would have been interested to find out if she even got within 5 feet of her.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Crazy stuff, but it missed and planted in the wall, I guess.
Huh.
Well, that's it for this week's Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals. I guess Dark Ages Battle Armor edition, Tim.
Yeah.
I've had a good show. I hope you guys did, too. Thanks for tuning in. Remember, if you want to get any of the books that you're featured on this show or on our Beyond the Darkness radio show every Saturday and Sunday, go check out darknessradio.com. Click on the store tab. You'll find my Amazon storefront there, and you can go in and get all of the books, plus all the cool swag that I found, paranormal-related swag, including ghost hunt tools and more. You can find that all on the page. Go check it out, darknessradio.com. Click on the store. And if you have not been listening to the best in paranormal talk radio, not only do you get the best in true crime talk radio every week, go check out our weekends, Saturday and Sundays, as we discuss all aspects of the supernatural. It's a free show. At least it is for 90 days. You get to listen to those episodes for 90 days, and they slip behind the paywall. That's a whole lot of time to get to listen, Tim. So you should be able to power through those with no problem, folks.
That's definitely.
So, all right. Well, that's it for this week. That's Tim. I'm Dave. You've been listening to the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday.